in its matchbox-sized casing. Over the years, he'd rigged up infrared light beams to photograph nocturnal wildlife, staked out the love nests of cabinet ministers, tracked and photographed the movements of nuclear waste on secret midnight trains, climbed over fences, sneaked cameras into places he and they should not have been. Patience, detection, subterfuge, and record. What historians did for a living was far more mysterious to him than the work of spies. My vision blurs. We carry the lives we've imagined as we carry the lives we have, and sometimes a reckoning comes of all the lives we have lost. The summer lunch recedes. I cannot pull it back. Fog seeps in from the rugby pitch where Prideaux strode. Slow, white breaths. There's a hush in my head. It grows louder. I'm not a spy, I told my father. I'm a historian. But watching everyone around the table, their faces entranced by my hawk, it seems I'm not even that anymore. I am the fool, I think dully. I used to be a research fellow, a proper academic. Now I am in Motley. I am not Helen anymore. I am the hawk woman. The hawk pulls on the rabbit leg. Wasps circle her like electrons. They land on her feet, on her nose, seeking shreds of rabbit flesh to take back to their paper nest in some nearby Cambridge loft. She flicks them away with her beak, and I watch their yellow and black striped abdomens spinning through the air before they right themselves and fly back to the hawk. This summer lunch feels deeply unreal. Shadows of damask and silver, a photogravure in an album, something from Agatha Christie, from Evelyn Waugh, from another time. But the wasps are real. They are here and they are present. So is the hawk, the sun at their centre. And me? I do not know. I feel hollow and unhoused, an airy, empty wasp's nest, a thing made of chewed paper after the frosts have murdered the life within. Sometimes a reckoning comes of all the lives we have lost, and sometimes we take it upon ourselves to burn them to ashes. In the evenings, by the light of the Aladdin lamp, in the soft white glow of its fluorescing mantle, White is doing his old life to death. He is committing the murder in a novel he started writing at Stowe, and now it is nearly finished. The book is called You Can't Keep a Good Man Down, and it is a story of the decline and fall of a public school headmaster called Dr. Prisonface. Prisonface is terrified of life. He is a chameleon, a mirror, existing only through his reflection in the eyes of others. He loses his job at the school. He woos and is rejected by a boyish, dark-haired barmaid, flees in terror from the advances of her mother. He flies with drunken aviators descended from romantic poets. He tries to teach Hollywood moguls how to be gentlemen, and is humiliated when they mow down grouse with Tommy guns. The book is a vicious satire on the educational system and the cult of the English gentleman, but it is also a psychological exorcism, a caustic narrative written to burn away his former life. White called Prisonface to life in order that he should suffer, be punished, mocked, reduced to rags, and die. From headmaster to private tutor, from farm worker to beggar, he fails at everything he attempts. Everyone he meets on the way lectures him on why he is useless and unreal, and the book's narrator, too, puts the boot in at every opportunity. Towards the end of the book, limping and homeless, Prisonface meets a mysterious man on a country road. The man has saturnine, strangely carved features and walks in darkness, a black dog by his side. He is a supernaturally suave figure. Prisonface is drawn to him, drawn to his power, recognizing in it the wisdom of certainty, the happiness of reality, the mastership of right. The stranger had once been a schoolmaster too, at a place called Golden Gates, but left because he could not bear the people teaching there. Now he is married, lives in a cottage in the woods, and is content. The man is White's vision of his future self. A White freed, a White triumphant, a man who lectures Prison Face over several pages on the failings of the school system. To anybody who has spent 2 months training a goshawk, knowing that it will be fatal even to give the creature even a cross look, the man says, it seems very extraordinary that the complex psychology of a human being can be taught with a stick. Sitting by the lamp, White finishes writing the speech that is perhaps the least cruel, the most humane in the whole book. He is speaking to his past self with pity and compassion. You went back to school voluntarily from the university because you still needed to go to school, because there was something still to find. You went back under the hen's wing for safety because you were still too small a chicken, but also in search of something. You want the talisman that would make you fit to leave. What am I searching for? That you will only know when you find it. Is it wisdom or manhood? Perhaps it is love. Perhaps it is love. Perhaps it is. I imagine him writing those lines in his small kitchen, the light wet on the oilskin tablecloth, the night close against the window. He will stoke the fire in a little while. First he will write a little more. His hawk is sleeping. All the leaves on the trees of the ridings are still tonight, all unmoving out across Three Parks Woods, across Stowe Woods and Sawpit Woods, over the Black Pits ponds, the carp slumbering deep in the waters. There is peace here. He is a wicked man, a free man, a man who is cast out, the man who fell. Feral, ferox, fairy. A man who is content with his lot. He puts the pen down to pour another drink, then picks up his pen and writes some more. He writes of Dr. Prisonface asking the mysterious man his name, and of the man telling him it is Lucifer. Lucifer the Lightbringer, the fallen angel, the devil incarnate. Chapter 14. The Line. The expression on Christina's face is unusual. It's not a happy face, but it's not unhappy either. Tense, certainly. It is fierce, ambivalent, and brave. Today she'd come out to watch the hawk fly, and in a burst of inspiration, I decided to recruit her as my under-falconer. She'd borne my grief-spurred strangenesses with great good grace over the last few months, but nothing could have prepared her for this. The problem is, I can't get away fast enough, I tell her. She flies after me as soon as I start walking away, but she has to come longer distances before I can fly her loose. Can you hold her for me, out on the pitch, so I can call her from your fist? You'll have to show me how, she says, paling. It's easy, really. I give her my spare glove, put the hawk on it, and bend her fingers into the right shape to hold the jesses. Turn your back to me. Yes. Like that. Perfect. Now she can't see me. So I'm going to walk over there. When I shout okay, turn right, stick out your arm, and open your hand, so she can fly. She bites her lip, nods. Make sure you turn the right way. You don't want to get the crayons caught round your legs. She holds the hawk with cautious concentration, as if it were a pitcher full of some caustic agent. She stands straight-backed, still and composed, a small figure 15 yards away in skinny black jeans, T-shirt and bright red sneakers. Okay! She turns and Mabel bursts towards me, dragging the crayons behind her, flying so low her wingtips almost brush the turf. With each deep wing beat, her body flexes and swings, but her eyes and head are perfectly, gyroscopically still, fixed and focused on my glove. The silvered undersides of her wings flash as she spreads them wide. Her tail flares, she brings her feet up to strike, and she hits the glove feet first like a kickboxer. Was that okay? Shouts Christina. I give her a thumbs up, and she responds the same way. For a moment, we're two traffic controllers on the flight deck of an aircraft carrier. We do it again and again. The next day brings heavy rain, so we fly her loose between us in the front room of my house, back and forth from fist to fist, over the rug, past the mirror, under the light, wings sending up drafts that leave the lampshade swinging wildly. By the fourth day, the hawk is flying 25 yards to me, will come without hesitation from the ground, from Christina's fist, from tree branches, from the roof of the pavilion. "Thank you so much for your help," I tell her as we walk from the field. "You know, I think we're nearly there. Once she flies a full 50 yards, I'll let her loose." The thought brings a squirmy, high-pitched joy. I mustn't rush. I cannot wait. I had called so many hawks before, but calling Mabel was different. I stood there, raised my arm, and whistled the whistle that meant, "Please come. This is where you want to be. Fly to me. Ignore the towering clouds, the wind that pushes the trees behind you. Fix yourself on me and fly between where you are and where I am." And I'd hear my heart beating, and I'd see the hawk crouch and fly. I'd see her drop from the perch, speed towards me, and my heart would be in my mouth. Though she was still on the creance, I feared the faltering. I feared the veering off, the sudden fright, the hawk flying away. But the beating wings brought her straight to me, and the thump of her gripping talons on the glove was a miracle. It was always a miracle. "I choose to be here," it meant. "I eschew the air, the woods, the fields." There was nothing that was such a salve to my grieving heart as the hawk returning. But it was hard now to distinguish between my heart and the hawk at all. When she sat 20 yards across the pitch, part of me sat there too, as if someone had taken my heart and moved it that little distance. It reminded me of Philip Pullman's children's fantasy series, His Dark Materials, in which each person has a demon, an animal that is a visible manifestation of their soul and accompanies them everywhere. When people are separated from their demons, they feel pain. This was a universe very close to mine. I felt incomplete unless the hawk was sitting on my hand. We were parts of each other. Grief and the hawk had conspired to this strangeness. I trusted she would fly to me as simply and completely as I trusted gravity would make things fall. And so entrenched was the sense that the hawk flying to me was part of the workings of the world that when things went wrong, the world went wrong with it. She'd left Christina's fist with all the joy and certainty in the world. I watched her approach and waited with happy anticipation for the solid thwack of her landing on my glove. But it did not come. Instead, she snatched at the food in my fist with one down-dropped taloned foot and kept flying, fast, out and away from me. I could feel the failure in her, the sense that she hadn't got what she wanted, and I could feel, too, that what had just happened had spooked her, and that now she was flying away from it and me as fast as possible. I grabbed hold of the creance and ran with her, putting resistance on the line until she was brought to earth, crest raised, wings spread wide, feet planted in the turf, beak open, panting in fury. I held out my fist, and she flew straight up onto it, as if nothing had happened at all. "She must have been scared by something," I said. "Let's try it again." And again the hawk came, low and fast, and again she snatched at the glove and kept flying. Again I brought her to earth. "Why is she doing it?" "I don't know. I don't know." This had never happened before. Over the years, I'd had hawks that ignored me, hawks that turned their back on me, hawks that flew reluctantly, flew badly, or didn't fly at all. It never worried me. These hawks weren't at their flying weight, that was all, and this was easily fixed. But This was different. This was a hawk desperately eager to fly to me, but with a last-second terror of landing on my glove. It was incomprehensible. I telephoned Stuart. I don't know what's wrong. Does she need more manning? Is she too high in weight? I was as bewildered as a child. What should I do? There was a long pause, and then a longer sigh. Are you feeding her chicks? He said. Yes. Stop feeding her chicks. They're too rich for her at this stage. She'll be fine. She's nearly there. Just feed her rabbit. It won't hurt her, but it will stop this problem. All the trust I had left in the world rested in the fact that the hawk wanted to fly to me. Now she was scared to land on my fist. She didn't trust me. And I could not explain to Stuart how awful this felt. I thanked him. I had asked for advice, and he had given it simply and precisely. This is the problem. This is how you fix it. But I didn't believe him. It can't just be the food. I have done something bad, I thought miserably. Something terrible. The next day, a plague of moorhens had come out of the messy copse behind the pavilion and were running all over the pitch like a flock of feathered black mice. Moorhens. Birds that can neither fly well nor run fast. They are such easy prey for goshawks that falconers avoid flying them out of a sense of sporting fair play. Mabel had never seen them before, but she looked upon them now as if they had been designed by a kindlier deity for her personal delectation. I wasn't surprised. I'd already discovered that all sorts of predatory taxonomies are buried in a baby goshawk's brain. A few days earlier, I'd seen her looking at a small drawing of partridges in a book I'd left open on the floor. Intrigued, I picked up the book and held it in front of her. She kept her eyes fixed on the picture, even when I moved the book about in the air. No way, I thought. The drawing was in ink. It was stylized and sparse. It caught the feel and form of partridges, but there was no color or detail to it. I flipped through the book, showed her other drawings, finches, seabirds, thrushes. She ignored them all. Then I showed her a drawing of a pheasant. Her black pupils dilated. She leaned forward and stared down her beak at it, as fascinated as she'd been with the partridges. I was amazed. Amazed that she could understand two-dimensional images, and even more amazed that something deep in her brain saw these sparse, inked curves as fitting the category game birds, and had pronounced them worthy of interest. Right on cue, I hear a soft clucking noise and a thin peeping, and Mabel's head swings round and mine too, and we see just there, 10 feet away, a hen pheasant and a line of cheeping, half-feathered poults squeezing themselves under a railing on their way towards the grass. The pheasant sees Mabel and stops dead. She has never seen a goshawk before, but instantly perceives the danger she is in. She crouches to fly, realizes this would leave her chicks behind, then considers sitting down and pretending to be a rock. And when she realizes the futility of this maneuver, her lacy beige back does not match the sun-lit grass, and the hawk has already seen her, all hell breaks loose. She stretches her neck high, puffs out her cheek feathers, beak open in panic, and runs pell-mell out across the pitch. Her chicks follow her desperately, 6 ungainly clockwork dinosaurs. I am bewildered. There is no safety out there, nowhere to hide, unless the pheasant thinks that putting her chicks amongst the distant moorhens would give them a faint, statistical chance of escape. Mabel, oh God, Mabel. Mabel is baiting at them, baiting so hard, wings beating so furiously, that she hangs horizontally in the air. The breeze is cold in my face, my fist pulled towards the fleeing pheasants. She bounces back onto my hand, beak open with exertion, fixes me with a white, hot, angry eye, then Bates towards them again. "Not here, not now, Mabel. I can't let you catch one. It is against the laws of God and man and college." I try to keep her on my fist, which is like trying to balance a very tall and unstable pile of precious china plates, execute a smart volte-face to block the pheasants from view, and in the excessively polite voice that only ever falls on me at times of enormous stress, I ask Christina if she might possibly chase the pheasants back into the bushes, and perhaps the moorhens too. She grins and shepherds the pheasants back into the garden behind the railings. Then she sprints off across the pitch towards the moorhens. Meanwhile, Mabel is standing on tiptoe, jumping up and down, craning her neck over my shoulder to see where they have gone, and I'm trying to stop her from seeing and largely failing. And I turn my head and see Christina running across the field, arms windmilling, and before her, scores of moorhens rushing back into the woods, wings open as they run, like small boys playing aeroplanes, and I start giggling uncontrollably. This is ludicrous. I'm holding tight onto Britain's deadliest hawk while someone chases all the game birds away. My God, I'm thinking. If any of my falconer friends find out about this, they'll never speak to me again. Once the pitch is clear of temptation, I call Mabel as usual. She flies to my fist perfectly a whole 30 yards, but on the second and third flights, she clouts the glove hard with both feet, skies up, tries to turn in mid-air, wobbles, stalls, then ends up on the ground a few feet away, panting, wings dropped, looking as if she's going to explode. All my laughter is gone. Now I know why Austringers have for centuries been famed for cursing. I curse. It is my fault this is happening. I know it is. I hate myself. I try to keep calm. I fail. Damn. 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 I'm hot, incredibly bothered, pushing hair from my eyes with rabbit flesh-specked fingers, cursing to high heaven, and to top it all, I see a man in white shirt sleeves and a black waistcoat striding towards Christina, his shadow dark before him. It is one of the college porters, and he is not happy. The set of his shoulders is unmistakable. They start talking. From this distance, I can't hear what's being said, but she is waving one hand towards me, and I suppose she's explaining to him that I am not a random trespasser, but a bona fide college fellow, and what I am doing is not against the rules. From his demeanour, I don't think he believes her. They stop talking as I approach. He recognises me. I recognise him. "Hello!" I say brightly, and explain what I'm doing with a hawk on this hallowed ground. He says, eyeing Mabel with suspicion. "Are you going to catch students with it?" "Only if they're causing trouble," then I whisper conspiratorially. "Let me have the names." It is the right answer, a shout of laughter. He is fascinated by the hawk and wants to know more about it, but he is working and duty calls. "Excuse me," he says. And he sets his shoulders once again, narrows his eyes into the sun, and stalks off towards some poor tourists who decided to have a picnic on the corner of the college rugby pitch. I flew her later in the day. I flew her earlier. I fed her rabbit with fur and rabbit without. I fed her chicks that I'd gutted and skinned and rinsed in water. I reduced her weight. I raised it. I reduced it again. I wore different clothes. I tried everything to fix the problem, certain that the problem couldn't be fixed because the problem was me. Sometimes she flew straight to my fist, sometimes straight over it, and there was no way of knowing which it would be. Every flight was a monstrous game of chance, a coin toss, and what was at stake felt something very like my soul. I began to think that what made the hawk flinch from me was the same thing that had driven away the man I'd fallen for after my father's death. Think that there was something deeply wrong about me, something vile that only he and the hawk could see. And every evening I wrote in the journal I'd kept since the hawk arrived. I made notes in terse, impersonal shorthand, detailing the weather, Mabel's behaviour, measurements of weight and wind and food. They read like aviation reports, things to be broadcast in clipped tones from the Air Ministry roof. 2 pounds, 1.5 ounces, light winds, sunny, 4 p.m, 35 yards, 4 flights, quick response, overshot last 2. Wash chicks. But they were changing. 2 pounds, 1.5 ounce, clear, slight breeze, 4:30 p.m, 3 flights, 35 yards, overshot every time. Awful. Rabbit? They were no longer entirely about the hawk. Dull. Headache. Hard to get out today. Am I ill? 2 pounds, 1.25 ounces, rabbit, 3 flights, 25 yards, overshot on last. Why? Have to fix this. What am I doing wrong? Sun. Stiff breeze, 4 p.m. Rabbit, but same as yesterday, 20 yards okay, at 25 overshot twice, 2 pounds, 1.25 ounces, rest of day horrible, because I had to see people, have to pretend everything fine, on and on, wish they would fuck off and leave me alone. The anger was vast, and it came out of nowhere. It was the rage of something not fitting, the frustration of trying to put something in a box that is slightly too small. You try moving the shape around in the hope that some angle will make it fit in the box. Slowly comes an apprehension that this might not, after all, be possible. And finally, you know it won't fit. No, there is no way it can fit, but this doesn't stop you using brute force to try and crush it in, punishing the bloody thing for not fitting properly. That was what it was like. But I was the box. I was the thing that didn't fit, and I was the person smashing it over and over again with bruised and bleeding hands. Rage crouched inside me, and anything could provoke it. One weekday morning I laboured into town under a sky the colour of wet cement to meet an Uzbek student I'd worked with on a research trip to Central Asia the previous winter. A quiet, neat man, a nice man. I'd camped with him in frozen deserts, eaten lamb-stuffed quinces at roadside shacks on the Silk Road, stood with him on the banks of the Sirdarya River. He had lately arrived in Cambridge, and he wanted to see me. I sat down with him at a cafe table. I liked him. I knew I should talk to him, but couldn't remember how. I tried a few words. They sounded wrong. I stuck a watery smile on my face and turned my head towards the window, desperately trying to remember how to have a conversation. And there, behind the plate glass of the bank across the street, a woman in a grey uniform was standing on a chair in her stockinged feet, reaching up to peel a huge vinyl sticker of a singing skylark from the glass. It had been advertising some kind of financial offer. Now the offer was finished, and so was the lark. She picked at its open beak with her fingernails, then started pulling its head from the window. Inch by inch, the bird disappeared. First it hung there, decapitated, printed wings spread wide. Then each wing was stripped from the glass, hacked at with fingers and a plastic scraper, until the last feather of its tail was gone. She screwed the skylark into a ball and threw it to the floor. Blind, cold, shaking fury. I felt it rise. I hated that woman. I wanted to burst into the bank, scream at her, pick up the tangled ball that was a skylark and take it home, smooth it out, save it from harm. Across the table, my student friend was looking at me with the same expression of baffled concern that the waiter had worn on the night my father died. That also made me angry. I was angry with the woman for tearing down the skylark, and angry with this nice, innocent man who gave me no cause to be angry at all. I mumbled an unsatisfactory apology, told him that things have been hard since my father died, and it isn't your fault, and I'm sorry, and this is awful, but I really have to go. I walked past the window as I crossed the street. The woman was back on her chair, smoothing a new sticker out against the glass, a giant arrow that pointed at nothing. I could not meet her eye. Then I started crashing my father's car. I didn't mean to, it just happened. I backed up against bollards, scraped wings against walls, heard the sound of metal squealing in agony over and over again, and I'd get out of the car and rub the new gouges dumbly with my fingers as if somehow that might fix them, though they ran through the paint to the metal below. "Are you punishing your father's car because he left you?" asked a psychoanalytically minded and fairly tactless friend. I thought about that. "No," I said, embarrassed because my answer was so much less interesting. "It's that I don't know what shape my car is anymore." It was true. I couldn't keep the dimensions of the car in my head, or my own, for I kept having accidents. I cracked cups, I dropped plates, fell over, broke a toe on a door jamb. I was as clumsy as I had been as a child. But when I was busy with Mabel, I was never clumsy. The world with the hawk in it was insulated from harm, and in that world I was exactly aware of all the edges of my skin. Every night I slept and dreamed of crayonces, of lines and knots, of skeins of wool, skeins of geese flying south, and every afternoon I walked out onto the pitch with relief, because when the hawk was on my fist, I knew who I was, and I was never angry with her, even if I wanted to sink to my knees and weep every time she tried to fly away. Chapter 15. For Whom the Bell.
"Bloody hell, she's calm, Helen," Stuart says. "I can feel her heartbeat. She's not bothered at all."
His head is bowed low over the table, fingers spread wide over the closed wings of my hooded hawk. He holds her upon a kitchen cushion as firmly and as gently as if she were made of glass. "Good," I say, shifting her covert feathers carefully aside to reveal the base of her tail. Here, just before the long feathers join her body, the quills are hollow and translucent, and I'm about to glue and tie a bell the size and shape of an acorn onto the topmost pair. It doesn't take long. I tug on it gently to check it is secured, then take the hawk back onto my fist. She rouses and the bell sounds loud in the bright room. It does not seem to concern her at all. Bells are among the most ancient of falconry technologies. For years I'd bought bells from Pakistan, hand-hammered from brass to a design of immense antiquity. But the one Mabel wears is American, modern, small and light, handmade from nickel silver. When she flies free, it will tell me where she is. Bells were traditionally attached to hawks' legs on tiny leather straps called buets. But a tail-mounted bell is much better for a goshawk, for they have an invariable habit of shaking their tails when they land. You can stand with your back to a tree with a gos in it and trace its movements from branch to branch behind you through sound alone. But bells aren't foolproof. Their sound is dulled by wind and distance, and a motionless hawk is silent. So when Mabel flies free, she'll also wear a tiny radio transmitter, and I'll carry the receiver that picks up its signal over my back in a black cloth case. Even with these double precautions, the thought of taking her off the créance fills me with dread. I had never lost a hawk. I'd never expected to. But once she's free, I'm convinced that Mabel will rocket away from me and disappear forever. I'm even more certain of this when I fly her a few hours later. This time she doesn't even snatch at the food in my glove, just flies straight past me until she's brought down to earth. Disconsolate, I carry her back to the edge of the village playing fields. Stuart watches me approach, looks critically at the hawk. He rubs the back of his neck with one hand. His face, tanned and lined by years of sun and wind, is thoughtful and grave. "It might be the bell, do you think?"
I say. Freaked her out a bit. He frowns. It's a new place too, but she's not ready yet, Helen. Not yet.
He feels her breastbone speculatively.
She needs to calm down more. She's still too fat. Are you feeding her rabbit? Just rabbit?
I nod miserably. He looks at me, considering.
Tell you what, Helen. Come out on the hill with me tomorrow, he says. I'll be going up there to fly the Tearsall. We'll get her out into the fields, away from streets and houses. She needs space.
That would be brilliant, Stuart.
I'll pick you up at 5.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
She needs to calm down a bit more, Helen.
He was offering to help, and I was unprepared for how this made me feel. I'd flown scores of hawks. I'd taught falconry to beginners. I'd written papers on it, had lectured on its venerable history. But now I bowed my head before Stuart. He knew what to do. He knew about goshawks, and I did not. I felt weak with relief at not having to be an expert any more. There he was, rolling a cigarette, reassuringly calm and kind, a proper, generous friend. And it was there, standing on the edge of a village playing field, that I gratefully stepped into novicehood again, as if I had never seen a hawk in my life.
Need to excel in order to be loved,
White had written in his dream diary. But there is an unspoken coda to that sentence. What happens if you excel at something and discover you are still unloved? White was triumphant. Goss had come a whole 100 yards on the creance, was ready to fly free. He could say truthfully now that he had trained a hawk. But something terrible was caught up in his triumph. For the first time since the hawk arrived, White felt exposed. Being a novice is safe. When you are learning how to do something, you do not have to worry about whether or not you are good at it. But when you have done something, have learned how to do it, you are not safe anymore. Being an expert opens you up to judgment. In his hawking daybook, White began writing about critics and how he might avoid the kicks which frightened me. He felt it necessary to explain that his self-satisfaction was not egotism, but actually a horrible surprise at being good at anything after having been so bad at living for 30 years. And all the authoritarian figures in his life, under whom he had lived in fear, coalesced in his imagination into an elderly falconer with a waxed moustache who would read his book and consider him a fool. He knew he must explain to that man that what he had written was only the book of a learner. The words in his daybook read very like a prayer. May I hope that this book will receive the oblivion of those Ostringers on the one hand, and of those critics on the other, who realize that indifference and a supposition of non-existence sometimes are the most killing weapons. May I hope that some will realize that I am only a man. He is only a man. Success is a pressure. He cannot quite bear it. It boils and bubbles, and without knowing it, quietly and cruelly, he begins to sabotage his success, because success cannot be born. It is so very easily done. Stuart pulls off the road onto a farm track to the west of the city. The evening is warm, but there's a torn paper whiteness behind the sun that speaks of frost to come. I unhood the hawk. Her pale eyes stare out across a hillside of stubble and chalky till, at slopes cut with hedgerows, crisped at their edges into shot silk taffeta. She sees skeletal teasels and fence wires, larks calling overhead, a discarded 12-gauge shotgun cartridge by my feet. Red. She glances down at it, then up, fixing her gaze on something 3 fields away, delighted at this enlargement of her world. When Stuart takes her upon his fist, she leans back and stares up at him with almost comical dread, head sunk deep into her shoulders. But soon she relaxes. For all his strangeness, there is a kindness to him, an ease and proficiency in his dealings with her, that quickly reassures. We unwind the creance and call her across the bare field. She flies badly, of course. I see that flinch as she approaches, that moment where all conviction and trust slides away and I'm revealed to her as a monster. Once again, I grab the creance and bring her to earth. Her feet sink into the friable loam. She looks down in wonderment at her half-obscured toes. Stuart is firm with me, tells me she needs to be keener. I cannot bear it. I get him to swear that my hawk won't die in the night. Of course she won't, he says, blue eyes crinkling into something between a smile and a frown. Are you sure? I say pathetically. I am horribly worried that I am starving her to death. He extends a hand and feels Mabel's breastbone, her ribcage, the muscles under her wings. She's fine, Helen. Honestly, yes. I trudge back to the car, staring down at my feet. Then Stuart stops dead. Stuart? Look, he says. Look at that. What? I say, turning and shading my eyes. I can't see anything. Look towards the sun. I am. Look down. Then I see it. The bare field we'd flown the hawk upon is covered in gossamer. Millions of shining threads combed downwind across every inch of soil. Lit by the sinking sun, the quivering silk runs like light on water all the way to my feet. It is a thing of unearthly beauty, the work of a million tiny spiders searching for new homes. Each had spun a charged silken thread out into the air to pull it from its hatch place, ascending like an intrepid hot air balloonist to drift and disperse and fall. I stare at the field for a long time. It reminds me of an evening last autumn on that trip to Uzbekistan. I'd been sitting on the ground outside my tent, wondering if the terrible smell was a decomposing cow or something much worse. Before me were miles of marsh and desert, and in the far distance the Fergana Mountains fading into haze. Then I saw the strangest things hanging in the air, and I could not work out what they were. They looked like white question marks, and they disobeyed the laws of physics alarmingly. There was no wind at all, yet they hovered and sank and rose with supernatural slowness. What the hell? I ran after one. I walked up to it, so that it was within 6 inches of my nose, and I still couldn't understand what it was. It was as long as my hand from wrist to fingertip. It was white and squiggly, like the doodle you make with a running-out pen, and made of some material I couldn't identify. I thought of manna and soda, of ash and silly string. And then I looked very, very closely as it rose very, very slowly upwards. And there, from the base of this white, frothy squiggle, was an almost invisible line. And right at the bottom of the line was a spider exactly this size, the size of the word "ah." The next day, I left Mabel at home and took a train to London. I didn't want to leave her, and I didn't want to go. I remembered the city after my father's death as a ghastly place, pale and caustic under toppling clouds. But now, rounding the corner of Fleet Street, I found the city wasn't empty any more. It was a dark and fathomless warren of litter and glass, bankers and traders streaming through its sunken lanes, sills, barricades, alleys, tipping gutters, anti-pigeon spikes, pavements patterned with spots of trodden gum. And then, suddenly, St. Bride's Church, caged behind railings on a raised platform of green-stained stone. The picture editor of my father's newspaper was there, waiting with my mother and brother at the door. I had not met him before. Blue eyes in a fierce, sad pugilist's face, a strong handshake, a pinstripe suit. He'd set up this meeting. The newspaper was organizing a memorial service for my father, and we'd come here to discuss it with the canon of the church. And so, in the vestry office, we talked of hymns, of invitations, of readings and speakers and songs. I said I would make a speech. We talked some more. My mother sat very upright in a grey sweater and pink gilet, her hair carefully brushed, her face taut and pale. Oh, Mum. James was even paler. He shot me a tight smile. My eyes prickled and burned. He turned to the canon.
I work as a designer, he said. I could design the order of service.
The canon nodded and pushed a handful of printed booklets across the desk towards us. These are from past services, he said, dipping his head in a gesture of unconscious, anxious tenderness. They might help you with your father's. I picked up the nearest. On its cover was a smiling middle-aged stranger in a piano keyboard tie. I looked at his face for a long time, pressing the pad of one finger hard into the corner of the stiff cover to make a tiny flare of pain to cover the ache in my heart. When we got up to leave, the canon pressed business cards into our hands. Business cards? Absurd. The tie, the incongruity, this, all this. I looked back at the office. Strip lights and pinboards, coat hooks and fax machines, diaries and schedules. The offices of death. I felt laughter rising inside me. I tried to stifle it. It came out as a broken cough. This had happened before. Once, on the morning Mum and I had to choose my father's coffin, sitting in wing-back armchairs in the undertaker's office before a small vase of salmon-coloured roses, dim light, a cramped room, a stifling hush. The undertaker handed us a laminated folder, and it fell open onto a page of coffins painted with football colours, with photorealistic Spitfires, golf courses, saxophones and trains. We'd laughed then as I laughed now. The coffins, like the tie, made the small loves of life ridiculous in death. The business card made the memorial mundane. The laughter was because there was no way of incorporating these signs of life into the fact of death. I laughed because there was nothing else I could do. On the way home, I felt a great and simple sadness. I missed my dad. I missed him very much. The train curved and sunlight fell against the window, obscuring the passing fields with a mesh of silver light. I closed my eyes against the glare and remembered the spider silk. I had walked all over it and had not seen it. I had not known it was there. It struck me then that perhaps the bareness and wrongness of the world was an illusion, that things might still be real and right and beautiful, even if I could not see them, that if I stood in the right place and was lucky, this might somehow be revealed to me. And the sun on the glass, and the memory of the shining field, and the awful laughter, and the kindness of that morning's meeting must have thinned the armour of silence I'd worn for months, because the anger was quite gone now. And that evening, as we drove to the hill, I said in a quiet voice, "Stuart, I'm not dealing very well with things at the moment." I said, "I think I'm a bit depressed."
"You've lost your father, Helen," he said.
"I'm training a goss. I suppose it's quite stressful."
"You've lost your father, and you're doing okay with a goss," he added. "You might not see it, but you are. She'll be flying free soon. She's nearly there, Helen. Don't be so hard on yourself."
I hadn't told him everything. I hadn't confessed the unpaid bills, the letters from the bank, the impossible nights, the mornings in tears. But I had told him something. I looked at Mabel. Her head drooped forward. She looked indescribably mournful in her hood.
I stroked her craggy, snake-scaled toes. She was asleep. I touched the hood very gently and felt the whole weight of her sinking, sleeping head against my fingers. Perhaps I should ask Stuart to take us home, I thought. I was so impossibly tired. There seemed no point in flying her at all. But when I unhooded her out on the hill, Stuart, noticing her oddly upright stance, the pale feathers fluffed over her toes, the rising feathers on her crown, the shackly, possessive grasp of her feet on the glove, raised his eyebrows and asked, "What does she weigh?"
1 pound and 15 ounces.
"Look at her," he said. "She's a different hawk today."
She was. I called her. I had lost hope in her coming, but I called her all the same. And she flew to me. She flew like a promise finally kept. She raced towards me, wings flickering across 50 yards of flint-strewn earth, hit the glove, and stayed. I gave her back to Stuart and called her again. 3 times she flew to my fist, the whole length of the creance, with total conviction. There was no hesitation, no faltering. The hawk flew to me as if I were home.
"You've hit her flying weight," Stuart said approvingly. "Couple more days of this, and we'll get her flying free."
Of course, he was right. I had miscalculated her flying weight for weeks. But the narcissism of the bereaved is very great. I thought that the reason the hawk had flown to me was because I had confessed how bad things were. It had made me feel better, and it was this that had made me less off-putting to my hawk. "I must try to be happier," I told myself. "For the hawk's sake, I must."
Chapter 16. Rain.
White is making a trap. It is not easy. There is a testing practicality to this that pleases him. He has stripped an ash wand of bark and bent it into a U. He's given it leather hinges, covered it with 2 yards of knotted strawberry netting, and made it into a bow net, like the ones the old falcon trappers used. He's going to bait it with a tethered blackbird and catch one of the hawks in Three Parks Wood, or try to. He'd first seen them a month ago, and they'd never quite left his mind. They were nothing like Goss. They were small, fast, sharp-winged, aerobatic. They'd raced round a tree, wingtip to wingtip, in a perfect vertical bank, exactly like aircraft round the pylons at the Hatfield Air Race. An aviator's dream, a dream of the future. He reaches to pick up the reel of line that will pull the net over the hawk he will draw to earth, and he remembers an old nightmare. Fleeing in terror from a gang of thugs, he'd leapt into an aeroplane and piloted up towards safety. There was danger in the dream, a net of telegraph wires strung above that blocked his ascent to freedom. He is not sure what the hawks are. He knows they are not kestrels. It would be too much to hope for peregrines. Perhaps they are sparrowhawks. White's hawks in the wood weren't sparrowhawks. They were hobbies. Tiny, dark-hooded migratory falcons with rust-red trousers and thin white brows. Fantastically rare in the 1930s, they are much commoner today. They catch small birds and insects in mid-air. It would have been impossible to trap one with a blackbird tethered to the ground. But White thought they were sparrowhawks. And out in the wood, he built a hide of poles and branches and pegged the trap 15 feet away, strewing it with dust and leaves to hide it. He was neglecting Goss, and he knew it. The sparrowhawks were a new craze, his insensate Eldorado. He told himself he was catching one for Peter Lowe, a boy he'd taught who'd lost a pet sparrowhawk. He told himself he was catching them because training Goss was too easy, and he had to test himself against something harder. I think now that White's quest for the hawks
was his final test, of course. He was behaving like a fearful man who has finally won someone's love and, unsure whether that love can be trusted, decides it is safer to obsess about someone else. But when I was small, his actions were incomprehensible. "Why?" I'd howled. "Why did he abandon his goshawk? I would never have done that." My mother was wiping the bathroom mirror. I could see her face in it, and behind it my own, pale and outraged. It was my first reading of the book. I'd reached the bit about the sparrowhawks, and I was too upset to read any more. I'd jumped from my bed and gone looking for reassurance. "Is this the goshawk book you've been telling me about?"
"Yes. He's got his hawk ready to fly free, but then he starts making traps to try and catch some sparrowhawks, and goes off and leaves the hawk behind, and it's stupid."
A long pause. "Maybe he was tired of his hawk," she said, the hand with the cloth in it now pressed to the sink. This made no sense at all.
"But how could he be tired of a hawk?"
And now she saw I was upset, and she put down the cloth and drew me into a hug. "I don't know, Helen. Perhaps he was a silly man." Goss's small, feral head, tipped and streaked and patterned like a cat's, looks about in puzzlement. This is not what normally happens. His sharp black beak opens and closes. He is hungry. He hops along the railing around the well, gripping it tight with toes and claws. Flakes of rust fall. Hungry. He hops further, looking down the long line of the creance and still not finding the man at the end of it where he always is. Where was he? Goss needed vantage to see. So he flew across to the nearest tree. There was a branch just above him. He flew up to it. Hawks hate to sit in a lower perch when a higher one is offered, and so he hopped and scrambled onto the one above him, and then onto another, and another, laddering up the tree, pulling the creance behind him. Soon he sat at the very top of the unclimbable oak, the world offering itself to him, the skies fletched with pigeons, the fields sinking towards Stowe, the roof of the palace and its glittering lakes and all its obelisks and temples and classical avenues, all the lines of sight cut into the landscape by men 200 years ago, with his small, hawkish face looking down upon it as if this view, this perfect view, was the reason it was made. White had only left Goss on the railings for a minute. He'd heard the farmer's car and ran across the field to tell Mrs. Wheeler about his new wireless set. When he got back, Goss was not on the well, but on top of a tree, a shadow against the sky, and the twigs and branches below him woven and tangled with twine. He whistled, waved food, but the hawk didn't move. He panicked and pulled on the creance, and it made Goss bait and the twine more tangled than ever. He started to worry the creance would snap.
"It had hardly any breaking strain," he wrote. "It had already been broken twice."
The hawk was held tight. Powerless, White called for someone to help him. But the arrival of the farmer's son in a white shirt carrying a ladder made the hawk bait even more. Soon, Goss was hanging upside down in a cocoon of fraying string, feathers breaking in his struggle to free himself, before finally he hung unmoving, exhausted, immobilized, a feathered fly in a tarred and knotted web. It was an hour and a half before White entangled his jesses with a screw hook fastened to the end of a salmon rod, dragged him down to the ground, and got him back on his fist.
"You bloody little sod," White hissed at Goss.
The hawk, he wrote, looked at him angrily, as if it had all been my fault. "A couple more days, and I'll fly her free. A couple more days." But then a series of summer storms send cold water running in sheets along the ruffled tarmac and shell the roof with twigs and leaves. It is terrible flying weather. so instead of going up to the hill, I exercise Mabel in the park. I tie the swivel to the creance and lower her to the ground. She jumps to the grass crabwise and looks up at me hunched and baleful. Then I put a scrap of food on my glove, raise it high.